This is Rusty Tanton.
And Amber Ray.
And you're listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network, the show focused on all things Atlanta and sometimes elsewhere.
It's June 30th. This is Amber and
Alyssa of MissMisc.com.
Yeah, she has her own real blog.
I have a new
big girl blog. All grown up on WordPress. Anyway, we're sitting up here on the roof of my apartment building, and we're going to talk about two things that we're going to try to make them vaguely related.
they're vaguely related.
Yeah, children's publishing and Harry Potter.
See? Yeah, they go hand in hand.
So, first of all, children's publishing.
Right.
Well, Alyssa, what would you like to say about that? Just get us started.
Sure. I've been working in children's publishing now for almost 3 years, and I kind of wanted to have this an opportunity to give people some pointers on the industry in general, if you're interested in getting into the industry, you know, writing a children's book, maybe the do's and don'ts.
This started from me asking a question, not particular to children's publishing, but just in general, like, if you want to get a book published,
right,
what should you do and what should you not do to come off as an asshole?
Exactly.
Pretty much.
And my initial response is always, the first thing to do is do your research. Know the company that you're submitting to. Because my biggest pet peeve is getting submissions that right off the bat are a waste of my time. Things that my company does not do. And it's such an easy thing to do. Go to the company's website, take a look at their list, because almost every publisher has a website that has all of their books listed. Get a feel for the kind of things that you're doing. Because you're going to save yourself time and us time. You're going to save yourself money on sending out your 5,000, 50,000 word adult fiction erotica manuscript to me, who obviously has no interest in looking at that. Well, I might have interest in looking at it, but it's not going to work for my field. Let's see, what else can I... Do you have any questions that popped up other than that?
Well, okay,
so here's...
This is just sort of a curiosity question. You've gotten a lot of manuscripts that are fully illustrated.
Mm-hmm.
How common is that? And if that happens, do the illustrations usually end up going along with the book?
It's about, I would say, almost 50-50 with picture books. And not always that people are serious about illustrating their work, but that they think it's very important to convey what they see in their brain as going along with the book, because picture books are a very unique form of literature. I mean, the pictures are sometimes more important than the words. If the story is only so-so, illustrations can totally lift the book to a new level. I mean, I think of books like David Wiesner's books. He did Tuesday, and, what is the other one he just came up with? Tuesday is his most famous book. It's the one with the frogs flying on lily pads. It's incredibly striking, and the book has, I think, 4 lines in it. So, just an example. So people understand the value of pictures. The problem is, if you're not an experienced illustrator, illustrating for picture books is also a very specific field. I mean, there are people who do nothing but that. So if the illustrations are bad, they're going to turn me off to the works.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, if it's poorly illustrated, is that going to get thrown out, or would you maybe give it a chance? If you think it's a good story and could be well illustrated, would you give it a chance?
I would definitely give it a chance. We actually instruct anyone who reads our manuscripts, I instruct them, if there are illustrations, disregard them, read the story first, and then look at the illustrations, but only if they're saying they're serious about wanting to write and illustrate. If it's just an example of, here's a basic layout of the book of how I envision it, I don't even bother to look at it, because I don't want my judgment to be swayed.
Right.
And we do works. We have done works with authors who were very serious about illustrating their own work, and we've had to persuade them out of it, because we know what's going to make a book sell.
Do you help them find illustrators?
We do. We have a stable of illustrators that our company works with. Because like any creative field, you're working with artists, both the authors and the illustrators. And artists, I mean, it's just reality. Artists are, neurotic people. And you have to know that, especially for picture books, there are specific deadlines you have to meet. It is a huge amount of work. And if you think about it, for a typical 32-page picture book, that's 17 to 20 full paintings.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on how the artist created, and that is if you think about how many artists, how much time they put into one painting, this is just as specific and detailed, and sometimes more, for like science and nature books. You have to illustrate down to details in grass and insects, and there's 17 of those paintings that have to be done, sometimes within a 6-month deadline. Mm-hmm. So you have to know that you're working with people that you can depend on. And especially when you work for an independent company like mine, you have to know that you have to get someone you know you're going to be able to work with again and again, or it's a waste of your time.
Do you base your decisions on things like whether people have written children's books before, or does that come into it at all?
It definitely comes into it. And again, it's a matter of marketing, because when you know that their previous work is out there and it's strong and it's had good reviews and they've gotten awards, it's only going to help your book. Because these people probably have fans, a built-in audience, not just consumers by, you know, parents and children who want to read this book, but libraries and schools. And because that's a huge market for us, is the school and library market. And if they know this author and know they produce quality work, then they're going to want to get everything that they come out with.
So what about somebody who's never done anything? I mean, what would your advice be to break into it?
They definitely have a harder job. And my advice is to be as professional as possible. The best thing is to get an agent. An agent, we count on agents to be our first eyes. We count on them to have discretion in sending us stuff that we know, that we know we want. So we don't have to worry about an agent sending us something inappropriate. They're going to send us something that they think would fit on our list. So they kind of take out that first step. And an agent, they're going to do a lot of grunt work for you. They're going to be sending the letters out to publishers. They're going to be able to get a wider diaspora of people because they have connections in houses that you don't have. There's a great book you can get called The Writer's Market, and it comes out every year new, and it's a listing of every publishing company and literary agent in the country, what they specialize in. Because even literary agents specialize. I mean, there'll be people who will send only to romance novels, or only to romance publishers, or only sci-fi publishers. And also do your homework. Get your stuff peer-reviewed. I can't emphasize the importance of that enough. You need to find someone who's going to give you an honest opinion on your work. Because if you're sending something that's low quality, what our criteria is for unsolicited manuscripts is it needs to be publishable quality. Something that is not going to need a whole lot of work, because that's just the level that we work at. We don't have the time to deal with someone, you know, we don't know how they're going to respond to edits. So there's a great group called the Society of Children's Books Writers and Illustrators, SCBWI. They have branches all over the country. Many of our authors and illustrators are members. And it's literally a group for people who are interested in writing and illustrating children's books. And they have peer edits groups where you can go and present your work and have people critique. They have editors from companies who will come and do workshops, and they will read and critique your work and send it back to you. So it's a great way to get experience in the field. And, you know, like any kind of writing, children's writing it's very specific. It's really hard to write for kids, but you have to be as dedicated to it as any other kind of writing. Picture books are short, yes, but you can't think of it that way. If you're going to be a professional writer, you need to write every day. You need to be in the habit of making it a part of your everyday activity, because you're not going to improve your writing unless you work on it every single day. And treat it like you would treat a job, would be my advice.
Do you have any other advice before we move right along to Harry Potter?
Well, I think it's interesting. I'll give a little segue from from children's publishing to Harry Potter. Harry Potter has literally changed the way children's publishing works. The most basic is page counts. For years, publishing, I think, didn't give children enough credit for having, A, the patience to read a longer book, and B, the intellectual capacity to follow a story of that length and complexity, which is a shame, because post-Potter, there have been so many amazing series and writers that have come forward and said, look, children can follow a storyline, they can follow characters, they'll recall details for years to come. And I think it's only improved. One of my very favorite authors of all time, Tamara Pierce, I was at a conference where she was speaking, and she said, I have to thank Harry Potter for the success of my books, because when she first published her first series, It was a 4-book series. When she first brought it to a publisher, it was supposed to be 1 book. And they made her break it down into 4 200-page books, which is amazing. And she had to throw out half of the material in her books because they thought it was too adult or that kids wouldn't be able to handle it. And so I wish she had kept that first manuscript. I would kill to see it. So I think it's interesting, and that Harry Potter transcends so many age groups. I have a friend whose daughter is 5 now, and she has been writing her own Harry Potter stories since she was 3.
Wow.
Completely on her own, just came up with these adorable, you know, short little ideas. And of course they're from a 3-year-old's perspective. So like Harry has magic teeth and he bites Voldemort and Voldemort dies. And I think there's one where Voldemort's mother comes and yells at him for being so evil. And my favorite quote from one of them is, "Voldemort is going to die because Harry is going to kick him so many times."
You know, I have to interject something because I was writing before I could write. I would dictate stories to my grandmother. And
that's exactly how she does it.
And so, when I was at my parents' house one time recently, I found a bunch of old stories that I'd written when I was a little kid. And one of them, it was about, like, this woman who was, well, girl, as far as I was concerned, who was in college.
Right.
And it was like, her mom drove her and dropped her off at college. And, like, I didn't have a concept. I just thought college was, like, another grade.
Right.
Like, after 12th grade, then college. Her mom dropped her off, and then, you know, at 3 o'clock, college was over.
That's fantastic. That's so great. And that's exactly what I mean. Like, kids are so much more sophisticated than we give them credit for. And, I'm obsessed with the Harry Potter books, and that's kind of how I'm known in my company. I'm the Harry Potter girl, which is funny because I work for a company that is not at all connected to Harry Potter at all. You know, we're completely separate from that world.
Well, so. Why don't you talk about Phoenix Rising for just a minute? Because,
sure.
Oh my God, how awesome is that?
Phoenix Rising was amazing. Phoenix Rising is a part of a Harry Potter conference. It's a Harry Potter conference, and it's incredible. It's the second one I've actually gone to, and it was run by the same people I went to the first one of last year, which is called The Witching Hour. And it's absolutely incredible. I can't even, like, use regular adjectives to describe it. It's incredibly intellectual. People think, here that I'm going to a Harry Potter conference, and they're like, what are you going to do? Like, pretend to cast spells and talk about how much you love Harry? And I'm like, well, no, it's actually incredibly scholarly. People present papers, they go through a selection process of what papers they're going to select, and 3/4 of the papers, well, it's probably about half and half. It's half scholarly and it's half fandom-based. But this year, the majority of the things that I picked were scholarly, because I realized last year that those were the ones that I enjoyed the most. And it's incredible the things that you learn, the things you don't think about in connection to the depth of, and it's another sign of how rich the Harry Potter world is, that you can find all of these incredible links to 1,000 different cultures. And a panel I went to at The Witching Hour last year was called Luna Lovegood as the Holy Fool. And there's a tradition in Russian literature of this character called the Holy Fool, who is a very simple person, but whose words are considered divine, and how they, in Russian literature, they will say things that seem to be not connected to the real world, but occasionally will say things that are of incredible value and directness, and how Luna is one of these characters. The things that she says, and then, like, what is it? She'll say things about death and about life and the hereafter, and they're incredibly potent and deep thoughts, and they always make Harry stop and think. And so it was amazing. It was a direct correlation between these two. How would you ever equate Russian literature, right, with the world of Harry Potter? And it was amazing.
And who knows if J.K. Rowling even
intended that?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It's that form of literary criticism where, you know, you get out of it.
I mean, it's probably, on the one hand, I feel like it's sort of stupid for me to sit here and say, like, wow, gosh, I can't believe there's so much to talk about with Harry Potter. Like, you know, because people say that, you know, about, like, podcasting conferences, like, how
right.
much can you possibly talk about? How many sessions can there possibly be? But, you know, so it's not like that I'm really incredulous, but I mean, it just, it, no matter what the field is, no matter what the subject is, it always just remains amazing to me that there's just like infinite permutations and things to talk about.
Absolutely. It's incredible. And I think that's something that I learned and that I see more and more having gone to, you know, Dragon Con now this year several times or for a couple of years, and the same kind of panels about all different movies and TV shows and books, and it's so rich. It's such a rich world. And, you know, the Harry Potter conferences, I think, have taught me a lot. And there's just a way of viewing things I read the books completely differently after hearing a lot of these presentations. And then, of course, you know, I get to go and squeal with other people about my favorite pairings. And there are silly things, like we play Quidditch, you know, Quidditch is played.
How does that work?
It's different every time. It's actually amazing how they do it. When at the Witching Hour, it was an outdoor game. It was kind of like a cross between field hockey and lacrosse. And they had like a goal, and the snitch was, it was some kind of rubber ball that they would throw in occasionally. I think I only went to one match, and it was.
I mean, did it work?
It worked. It worked great. It was amazing. The thing that didn't work was they had a conference in Vegas called Lumos, and it was water Quidditch. So it was kind of like water polo, and apparently one of the people in charge kept changing the rules like mid-game, and there was all sorts of drama, of course. Yeah. Whenever you get fandom involved, there's going to be drama.
So do you have any predictions for the seventh book? I don't know if I really have any, but I can try to pull some out of my ass.
Sure. I've actually been having a really, really, really hard time with this, because obviously I'm very active in fandom, and we've been having these discussions for months now. I'm having a problem deciding between what I think is going to happen, what I want to happen, and what I hope doesn't happen. I am firmly on the side, well, not firmly, but I am pretty convinced that Snape is innocent. I'm on the Snape innocent side, or not necessarily innocent, but not evil, per
right.
se. I think there's textual evidence to support both sides, but I think that Dumbledore knew all of the details of what happened between Snape and Bella, Narcissa and Draco, and knew that Snape was going to have to make this decision at some point to kill him. And I think Dumbledore also knew that he was dying. And so, in a way, Snape wasn't actually committing this murder. So that's the side that I'm falling onto, though I think there's definitely arguments for both ways. And I think Harry is not going to die.
He better not.
God, if he dies, I'm going to be so upset. And I'm going to be upset if the trio doesn't survive.
I know.
Because it's such a powerful image, and it actually struck me. I was rewatching Goblet of Fire, and the very last shot of the movie is this long-distance shot of Harry, Hermione, and Ron standing in a window watching the Beauxbatons' coach fly away. And it's such an incredibly powerful image, and that image repeated itself at the end of the last book with Hermione and Ron telling Harry that they will be with him wherever he decides to go and when he's in this battle with Voldemort. And it's where Harry gets his strength and has from the very beginning of the series. He can't accomplish all that he does by himself, ever. Even though he feels alone in a lot of the books, I mean, he is so much stronger when he has the two of them there. And I think it would be a real tragedy if that didn't survive through the end of the series. Because I think it's such a powerful, I think it's a really powerful image for kids to know, too,
right.
that, like, the endurance of friendship.
Yeah.
And that you can't go through life alone. You have to have a support system. I just think that's incredibly important.
I just don't see how he could die, or how the trio could die. I mean, you know, number one, I just don't see how J.K. Rowling could do that.
Exactly.
But I don't see it working or making sense either.
I'm sort of convinced that this is a red herring. She's notorious for talking about something before the publication of a book to throw people off, either on purpose or just, you know, from a little deviousness in her brain, or just kind of in a fun way. And I'm really, really praying that this is a red herring, that the death of Harry. I know that there's a rumor, or there's a theory running around that Harry is one of the six final Horcruxes. Mm-hmm. And I can sort of see the basis for that, but at the same time, I think it would be completely implausible. Because the prophecy says that Harry, that one cannot survive without the other. If Harry dies, then that is another part of Voldemort's soul gone, and then therefore the prophecy doesn't actually work. So I think Harry has to kill Voldemort, and so it just doesn't make sense to me for Harry to be a Horcrux. However, I do think it could be another living thing. There was someone put forth a theory, and it was an awesome one. It was another living thing, and I was totally buying it, and now I can't remember what it was.
Of course.
I know, but it was another animal. It was not a person, I don't think. Oh, gosh, I totally don't remember what it was. Anyway, but there was another, like, I do think it could be another living thing that we don't know about yet.
I think there's going to be something that's just nobody can even expect. Nobody
Absolutely.
Can even predict at all.
There will be a huge, huge twist. I mean, it's going to be like Sirius dying. Because Dumbledore dying was expected. In a literary tradition, in narrative tradition, it had to occur.
I know, but I have to be honest. I still was really thrown by that.
Really?
I was. I don't know. I don't know why. It caught me off guard, and I don't know why. And at first, I was not convinced that he had really died.
That's interesting.
And I mean, I'm not, even now, I'm not totally convinced, even though the more I thought about it, it does make sense.
Yeah, and Rowling has said over and over and over, no, he's really dead.
And that
I'm not
too.
Kidding.
But like
he's
when I
dead.
First read it, I was like, wait a second. And so, I don't know. And I'm also really torn on the Snape thing because, you know.
It's so hard. I mean, there literally is so much evidence to support both.
I just feel like at this point he's done so much to prove that he's on the dark side.
Right.
That it's like, why would you do all that and then we're still supposed to, you know, accept innocence?
And I think it's really interesting that Borders has put on this big Snape guilty, not guilty push for the book. And someone online was saying, wouldn't it be the ultimate kick in the head if we never know?
Yeah,
if she leaves us hanging, because she could totally do that. We might never see Snape or Draco again in this book. I mean, we literally don't know. Because we don't know if Snape took Draco and fled to Voldemort, or, you know, we don't know. We have no idea.
And that would actually, you know, as frustrating as it would be, that would also make good sense, because it would be like, you know, in life there are things
there are
we
things
never
we
know.
Never find out. I think it could be incredibly compelling. I would be pissed off. I know that. Okay, so question for you. Is there one thing that she could do, besides from killing Harry, that would make you, like, irrevocably angry? Because I have one.
Aside from killing Harry, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but what's yours?
If she kills Remus. Remus is my favorite character in the books. I just love him. And her systematically killing off all of Harry's father figures, it would just be the ultimate betrayal to me if she killed off Lupin. And I know this is a personal thing, and I'm stupidly attached to him, and oh god, if she my friend Patty, when she was reading book 5 and she got to the part about Sirius dying, she literally threw her book across the room. I was like, yeah.
That sucked.
It was very traumatic. I know I'm gonna be a mess at the movie. I just know it already. I'm gonna bawl like a baby. Every time I watch Goblet of Fire and Cedric dies, I'm done. I'm totally done. I'm a crier when it comes to books and movies.
Me too.
So, okay, do you think Harry will come back to school or not?
Yeah, I think he will. I think he has to. I don't know. I mean, it was never really that much of a question for me. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like the natural progression of things.
It'll be interesting to see how she handles that, I think, because is there a Hogwarts without Albus Dumbledore? He's such an integral part of the school and of the appearance of the school. And I agree. I think that he will be returning, mostly just because it's a school. Technically, these are school stories.
Right.
If you're looking for genre, you know, it's structured for the 7 years that he would be there. So I think he has to return in some form. But I have a feeling that a large part of the story will be taking place outside of Hogwarts, and especially when we see the war, because obviously we're going to be seeing huge chunks of the war. And I'm really interested. I'm interested to see how she handles that as well, and keeping this in the context of a YA, and a young YA audience.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to, there's quote-unquote teen, and then there's quote-unquote young adult. And I think, though she's been increasing the age limit with every book, she does know that there are going to be younger readers reading these, and I don't think we're going to be seeing as graphic depictions of war as we might see in other teen lit. I think this is probably going to stay a YA, you know, 12 to 16 kind of age range.
But I have been impressed with how she hasn't shied away from addressing and confronting difficult subjects. And that's like what you were talking about with giving kids credit. Mm-hmm. They can handle these things and that they will have to in their lives.
Absolutely. I mean, she's hit a lot of really tough subject matter, and in subtle ways too, like in things you wouldn't really think about. I mean, slavery, the issue of man's rights with the house elves, and the sort of the stagnation and the acceptance of these evils in culture. You know, the wizarding cultures, oh, that's just how they are. And, you know, and a lot of people have attacked Rowling for writing the characters as being wanting to be, oh, no, they like it, they want it. And you see that in the difference between Dobby and Winky. Mm-hmm. Wheezy?
Winky.
Isn't it? Yes, it is Winky. Oh, God, I should know that. Terrible Harry Potter fan. But, you know, think just subtle things like that you don't think about. And then, you know, women's rights, the difference between women and men. And there have been reams of feminist literature about all of the Harry Potter women. And there are people who believe that she has demoralized women with every single one of her female characters. And I actually went to a panel at Phoenix Rising this year that was about Dolores Umbridge and her role as a feminist or anti-feminist character. And it was fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And she came down on the side of that she was actually a really strong female character. And again, it's so easy to see like these characters as black and white, but they're incredibly deep. I mean, they have to be to support this kind of analysis.
Well, there's no good way to wrap this all
up.
We'll
have to come back and discuss the seventh book after it comes out and our
and
thoughts
and
reactions.
You know what? That might take a while because, like, my friend Nikki is a really fast reader, and with all the Harry Potter books, she'll read and read and read. Like, one of them, she just stayed up all night and read it.
I'm guilty.
I cannot do that. I can't do it. I physically cannot do it, so you're going to have to give me a little more time.
I'll give you a little, we'll totally give you a little bit more time. Yeah, I'm notorious. I read, Order of the Phoenix, Order of the Phoenix came out. I read it in 8 hours. And then I read it again, like, I immediately started my reread, because I have to know what happens. I have to know. I can't wait, especially, oh God, with this book, I am going to have to know. And then I go back and to absorb. I really needed that with Order of the Phoenix, too, because Sirius Death just threw me for a loop.
All right, well, stay tuned, and in a few months, when I finish the seventh book, we'll come back and talk about all our thoughts, and don't worry, there will be spoiler warnings.
Yes, spoiler warnings everywhere.
The song you heard in this podcast was Flux by Drop Trio, available only on Magnatune.com.
Thanks for listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network. Visit us at gapodcastnetwork.com. If you have a question, comment, or drunken rant, leave us a voicemail by calling 678-389-9441. Who knows, it might be featured in a podcast. You can also email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com.